This feature of the Science News Radio Network is coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas. Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
And it's so good to have you with us again as we explore the exciting world of the business of emerging science, open innovation, and as, of course, started the show years ago, nanotechnology. We visit that once in a while, too. Today, we've got a very interesting show. Gentleman by the name of John W. Piper. He's a principal with Bering Security Risk Management Services. So John's going to talk about risk management and why it's important. It seems that the North American Electrical Reliability Corporation issued a directive that requires the total integration of cybersecurity and physical security at our power plants. And John is going to talk a little bit about that. He's got some interesting things to say, too, about drone warfare and why we need to really be watching developments with that. So we're going to get with John in just a minute. You'll find him fascinatingly interesting. He is a speaker at the 2016 International Conference on Homeland Security produced by IEEE. We're also going to visit the Den of Strangers, get more wisdom from somebody a lot of us never heard of. We're going to visit our Fountain of Useless Information we have here on the set in the second half of the program. Yeah, I'll give you a preview of what we're going to ask the Fountain of Useless Information. The California seagull is the state bird of what state? You think it's California, don't you? No, it's not. You're going to be very surprised. The state bird or the California seagull. And, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments are the voice of reason. But before today's guests, I want to remind those of you listening on radio, you can also hear us commercial-free online at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Well, this time I want to introduce John W. Piper. He's a principal of Bering Security Risk Management, and I know that may not mean a whole lot to you, but John has over 30 years' experience in petrochemical and nuclear security vulnerability analysis and risk management, and he's applied nuclear safeguards and security practices to the major petroleum and chemical industries over the years. He's going to be a very important speaker at this year's IEEE 2016 International Conference on Homeland Security Technologies, where key technical gaps are closely examined. It's going to go on the May 9th through the 12th in Boston. And if you want to find out more about that conference so that you can attend, go to our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a link. John is recently retired from the U.S. Secret Service after a 20-year career, having served as manager of the Forensic Sciences Division and the Technical Security Division, and was responsible for security engineering and risk management at the White House and Treasury Department complexes and other related facilities. So welcome to the program, John W. Piper. Yeah, so good to have you. You're retired from the U.S. Secret Service, and information that provided to me that they're down over 500 positions and can't seem to get approval for a fast track of hiring process. And the same thing can be said for the procurement processes. What's wrong with the Secret Service? I mean, we lost the director of the Secret Service. There's all these allegations of prostitution and people breaking into the White House grounds, and it seems to be in a mess. What's the solution here?
I'm 20 years out and did 13 years with ExxonMobil and 3 years in a nuclear weapons. So I've been away from the service for a while, although okay. I'm closely affiliated with a lot of its operations and former colleagues.
Okay.
The problem there is they've got an insider problem, a disgruntled small group of employees who are hell-bent on like a revenge motive against the organization. And when any organization, I don't care if it's CIA or NSA or FBI or anybody has got some senior insiders who are nestled up next to a Washington Post reporter, you've got a problem. And that's essentially what's going on.
Can you clarify that a little bit? I don't understand. Being a reporter myself, of course, I'm quite interested in where you're going with this.
Well, you know, they're documenting everything that goes on that's derogatory and reporting it right to the news media.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, isn't that what the news media is for? I mean, aren't we reporters supposed to be reporting things that are wrong?
Yeah, but if a similar incident occurs in the FBI, it's on page 26. If it occurs through this particular reporter, it's on page 1.
I see. Okay. So it's the reporter that's at fault here more than it is the agency.
No, she's got her job to do, and she got the Pulitzer Prize for it. And, you know, she's just a steady stream of information right directly out of the heartbeat of the agency.
Mm-hmm. And it's people within the agency trying to embarrass the agency, you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay.
Can I tell you one more story here?
Yeah.
Go ahead. On TSA, okay, I was doing a major risk assessment for a major airline at a major international airport in the United States. So, it's 5:30 in the morning, and in risk assessments, you generally want to look at, like, off-normal hours and see what's going on, you know, at night or early in the morning, whatever. So, me and my team are out in front of the airport at 5:30 in the morning, and up comes a gray bus, like a big school bus, only painted gray.
Mm-hmm.
About 40 guys, well, men and women, get off the bus, all dressed in Arabic headgear.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, you know, the guthras, the whole thing. So they're all carrying backpacks. So they trek into the airport, and the counter, you know, about 60 counters at least for airline check-in. Down at the end of that row of counters is a metal door with a card reader on it. So I watch the lead guy walk up, and he swipes a card. All 40 tailgating behind him.
Oh, my gosh.
Nobody used their cards.
Oh.
So then I said, who are those guys? And they said, well, those are Somalis. And I said, Somalis? I said, what's with that door that the one guy carted through? And they said, well, that's what they call a SIDA door, Security Identification Display Area. And I said, well, what happens after that? And they said, well, they just go to work. They're under the wing people. They service the cockpits, the airplanes, you know, handle the baggage, etc. And I said, you mean they don't go through any security screening? And the answer was, no, they don't.
Oh. Oh.
By virtue of the fact that they have a SIDA badge, they bypass security screening. So I said, well, how's that work? How do they get a SIDA badge issued? And they said, well, the State Department's got a clearinghouse where they approve SIDA access, basically. That, you know, that they've gone through some sort of vetting process that gives them an up or down. So I said, now are you trying to tell me that there's a National Crime Information Center in Mogadishu that the State Department can check?
Oh,
and they said, well, you know, quite frankly, we all know that system doesn't work and it's received some heat in the press. You know, that we really don't even know who these people are. So that then branched into a discussion about overall workers at airports. And it turns out that only two airports in the United States, Miami and Orlando, screen workers. At every other airport in the U.S., the workers get in with a hall pass.
Wow.
And this was written up in the Wall Street Journal not too long ago. You know, this is DHS for you. This is TSA. You know, the front door's locked. You and me get strip-fist by the machinery, and the back door's wide open.
Well, John, let me ask you.
I've been told 100 times that once you go into the cargo operations at airports, it's really wild. You know, if you're working in the cargo operations and you do not have a SIDA badge, all you have to do is walk across the runway. Nobody's checking this.
Well, is there anything that you want to do a wrap on and what you're going to do at the Homeland Security Conference? Is there something we haven't covered?
No, I mean the wrap is you can make very elegant decisions in a very sophisticated way.
Okay.
And you can have amazing results in a short period of time. And it has to do with technology features, and it has to do with procedures and other enhancements.
Well, John, do us a little service here. Put on the thinking cap a little bit. Look down the road a bit. 5 years, 10 years, I don't know, 20 years maybe. Where do you see us going? What do you see is maybe coming to us in the future that we should be paying attention to? Do you have a feel for that?
Yeah, probably in the studies that I've done in the last 5 years, close to 40% of our recommendations have been in the cybersecurity arena. And that would apply to both IT systems and industrial control systems.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes these systems are linked, so you know it's a one-stop shop for bad guys. They can take down the IT system and the industrial control system by developing things like Stuxnet, which will jump systems and contaminate both.
Mm-hmm.
Industrial control systems are fairly vulnerable. A lot of them are old and don't have security features that you would expect. That whole thing could be a huge problem. You start taking down power plants and things like that. I mean, an example of a futuristic kind of thing is NERC, North American Electrical Reliability Outfit, just issued a directive called SIP V5, which requires the total integration of cybersecurity and physical security. I'm making a presentation in a few weeks to a major airline on the integration of security and safety,
mm-hmm.
where you would have those two components in lockstep, because so many times you can have a safety breach of some kind that really is a security breach, but security doesn't get wind of it, they're not informed of it, you know, and sometimes they escalate out of control before the safety guys wake up and call the security guys, or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So a headline for me would be total convergence of systems, cybersecurity with regular security, safety and other systems with regular security. The convergence would be cost beneficial. It'd save a lot of money. In many cases, they would be 24/7 centralized operations where you could have a company with 100 affiliates having one of these control centers that would be looking at industrial IT cyber issues as well as physical and technical security issues.
All right.
That would be my headline.
That's fascinating stuff. How do you feel about the threat from drones now that everybody can go out and buy a drone and buy enough black powder to put on one and make a pipe bomb and drop it at an airport or on a moving train or a power line or something like that? You have any feeling about drone security?
Yeah, there's a huge threat from that. You know, I mean, the White House is concerned about it. Various other government agencies, the Pentagon and others, are very concerned about it. You have to have instantaneous decision processes. And again, this is amenable to a risk assessment. You know, what are your rules of engagement? When are you going to start shooting? You've got to sort all that out right quick, and you've got to have a decision process that can't wait for a lot of approvals or other considerations.
You're going to be speaking then at the conference. Give us kind of a preview of what we can expect to hear.
Well, I'd like to talk to the attendees, not so much about the specific technologies, but about the process, the decision process that allows people to make informed decisions about technology applications and also procedures.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
In security. I use a methodology that was originally developed at Los Alamos. It is now called NOAA Standard 882E, And that has been picked up by places like the Volpe Center up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, who were actually sort of the pioneers in terms of making the Los Alamos standard apply to security. So the process requires a multidiscipline team, usually of 4 to 6 people, to create scenarios, which are essentially undesired events in a penalty-free environment. And the scenarios are usually derived from detailed interviews, data reviews, tours, walkthroughs, and various other processes that make the team familiar with the process or the project. And then once you've developed a set of scenarios, you go through a structured brainstorming technique that requires an evaluation of existing safeguards and then a cause-effect analysis. So you ask yourself, if we have this scenario and if we have these safeguards, why is this still an open-ended issue? Why do we really have this scenario at the end of the day? And the cause-effect analysis essentially is something that causes you to do almost a root cause analysis of what's going on in the particular scenario. The scenario is then driven through several tables, a probability and consequence table, and you make a retrospective projection back to your tours and interviews and other things that have gone on, and then you calculate your risk on a risk matrix. Now, the risk matrix has been in use for a long time. In fact, it was invented by Aristotle.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, he invented the first one. It was a four-tier matrix, high-high, low-low, low-high, high-low. And it was a way to bring in multi-dimensions to a decision. And that's evolved, obviously, into a lot of scientific applications. You can have more complex matrices. One that I saw in the Navy was 7x9. You can have unusual ones. I've seen IT risk matrix that were a 2x8. The one that we've settled on pretty much is a 4x5, which is in common use. And another key component of this is to make sure that your organization is using the same matrix for different applications. So, for example, a safety matrix should be a 4x5. A security matrix should be a 4x5. Because when everybody's on the same sheet of music relative to risk calculations, senior management really has a true understanding of risk across multi-dimensions of the organization. And that's important because they have to make a whole array of decisions in terms of technology applications and budget resources and all the rest, and they need to know what the risks are and what the risk reduction would be. Now, the next phase of this, what they call the risk analysis phase, is you get into countermeasure recommendations.
Okay.
Where you make recommendations, or as we call them, opportunities for improvement, to mitigate the risk indexes that you've come up with in the first phase of cause-effect analysis. You then recalculate risk using the same tables and the same matrix and assume implementation. So at the end of the day on a project, you've got a quantified measure of risk, you've got a quantified measure of risk reduction, and to some degree you also have indications of residual risk, risk that the organization might be willing to live with for a while, or maybe risks that are not necessarily associated with the scenario.
So this is kind of a risk map that you can kind of look at and see the different risks and the degree of risk, and then what can be done to mitigate the risk. Is that what we're talking about here? Something that's very visible, that you almost a graphic?
Yes.
Okay.
It's easy to understand, and it's a process that is very amenable to team participation. You don't have to go through a big learning exercise to get someone engaged in this project.
Okay.
Now, this also mirrors other risk assessment techniques, such as event tree and fault tree analysis, and ALARP, as they call it, as low as reasonably possible, or HAZOPS, hazards and operability studies. They're all sort of intertwined. So at the end of the day, you can usually walk into technical people anywhere in the world and lay this process down on the table, and most of the time it matches the same process that the engineers and other technical folks are using to calculate their own risks. So a key component then is, how do you do these? Well, you start out usually with a series of interviews and questionnaires and tours and discussions and that sort of thing with the team. You can subdivide the team so that you're interviewing one interviewee with two team members. So if you've got a six-person team, you can interview three people simultaneously. And we have questionnaires that fit virtually any application, all the way from headquarters buildings to complex nuclear and petrochemical processes. But the key point here is your questionnaires and your investigation into this relies on cutting across the organization horizontally. So you want to touch on human resources, you want to touch on logistics, transportation, finance, safety, all these organizational components, and you cut across horizontally with a security inquiry.
So you're forcing the silos then to communicate with each other, where before they may only be very vertical in their own particular silo. Is that the idea?
Exactly right.
And let me ask you.
Yes, go ahead.
I was going to say, and I can well imagine that in these interviews you get a lot of disagreement. Does that happen? And then where do you find common ground?
Well, to back up one step, you emphasize to everybody right from the get-go that this is not an audit.
Okay.
Audits tend to look at existing situations and go backwards.
Mm.
You know, have you dotted your I's? Have you crossed your T's?
Okay.
This is a fact-finding exercise that attempts to make a forward projection to a more desirable state.
Got it.
So when you tell people that this is not an audit, there's no attribution, we don't record anything, we don't document who said what, there's no names involved in any of this, the atmosphere changes dramatically. We've had people actually tell us at the end of this of a project that they thanked us for not being auditors.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, nobody ever believes you when you first start this process, but by the end of it, they do.
Mm-hmm.
I've emphasized 100 times, this is fact-finding, not fault-finding, and when we show up on the doorstep for the first day of the assessment, they say the security audit guys are here.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a difficult hurdle to get over because they get audited so often on so many different things that, you know, we're just another crew in the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
But when you treat this as fact-finding and not fault-finding, people open up, the barriers drop, and generally we don't have disagreements, and generally we do find a lot of issues in the correspondences and relationships that exist between organizational domains.
Like some sort of issues of lack of communication, is that what we're talking about?
Well, yeah, a lack of communication, lack of security representation on different organizational components, such as other risk management processes that are going on, project management systems, HR practices in dealing with employee issues, all kinds of different issues come up in this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not difficult to optimize those relationships through this process.
Okay. Well, John, fascinating. And, of course, we're going to want a little bit more in-depth explanation on how these processes work. And we're going to have to break right now at the half hour. But when we come back, I hope you'll come back with us and give us a little bit more, a better view of exactly how you do these things. So I hope you stick around. Okay. As we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. Who in the Den of Strangers will we meet today?
Whitney Young, every man is our brother, and every man's burden is our own. Where poverty exists, all are poor. Where hate flourishes, all are corrupted. where injustice reigns, all are unequal.